You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hey, Connor, happy Earthling Day.
Hey, Andrew, happy Earthling Day to you too.
So I'll introduce us. I'm Andrew Day. You are Connor Eccles. And along with Robert Wright, we are the authors of The Earthling, the weekend edition of Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. And today we'll be discussing items from the latest issue of The Earthling. Bob will be joining us later to talk about some artificial intelligence stuff and maybe his ongoing trip down the JFK assassination rabbit hole. But before Bob joins us, you and I are going to discuss Defense Secretary nominee Pete Hegseth's views on Islam, Biden's decision to transfer landmines to Ukraine, gangs in Gaza looting humanitarian aid trucks, a Manhattan Project to build artificial general intelligence, Trump's nominees this week for top government positions, and some AI updates, perhaps not in that order. And after this kind of rapid-fire segment of topics, we'll discuss in a bit more detail some big news related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the Israel-Palestine conflict. So, Connor, take it away.
Yeah, so the first one I wanted to highlight was this story from the Washington Post that you just mentioned, which is that there are looting humanitarian aid. You know, this is a very interesting story in part because, as we note in the newsletter this week, basically, this is downstream of Israel's kind of commitment to destroying all aspects of the previously existing government in Gaza, including civilian police officers and others who Israel considers to be part of Hamas. So, you know, basically earlier in the war, these sort of Hamas affiliated police were the ones in charge of guarding and escorting a lot of these aid convoys. Over time, Israel made the decision to target them at times while they were doing these escort missions. And that has made it more or less impossible to protect them. And given that kind of general unrest within the Strip, given the general inability to stop anyone who might want to attack one of these convoys, these gangs have formed and become quite powerful and are basically looting and removing either valuable materials from the trucks, cigarettes are a particular one, or you know, any other types of like foodstuffs and things like that, and selling them at really increased prices. And there's one interesting quote. So the UN believes that this is happening kind of either under with the kind of tacit acceptance of Israel, or with even kind of active help in some cases. And one UN official that was anonymous in this piece told the Financial Times that, quote, these guys are probably the only people in Gaza who can get 100 yards from an Israeli tank or Israeli soldiers without being shot, end quote. So that's really stark. It's interesting to see the ways in which that's broken down. And it's related to another piece of news that I think that we're going to talk about later, which is that the International Criminal Court officially this week issued arrest warrants for both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as Mohammed Daif, one of the military leaders of Hamas in Gaza, who is presumed dead at this point, but the ICC was not able to confirm that. The charges that the Israeli officials are facing include this idea of the war crime of using starvation as a weapon of war. So that's something that we can talk about a little bit more later. But for now, I'm going to throw it back to you, Andrew.
Okay. So also this week, President Biden authorized the provision of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine. The transfer of these controversial weapons is intended to help Kyiv slow down Russia's military advances, especially in eastern Ukraine. These weapons are widely banned. More than 160 countries are signatories to the Ottawa Treaty, which bans anti-personnel landmines. But the U.S. and Russia are not signatories, and Russia has used landmines to great effect throughout the Ukraine war to defend captured territory. Landmines are controversial and widely banned because they kill indiscriminately, and they've been known to kill and maim civilians long after conflicts draw to a close, since they remain in the ground and are difficult to clean up. U.S. officials, though, said that they are sending so-called non-persistent mines, which either self-detonate or run out of battery charge within weeks, though some noted that non-persistent landmines often fail to self-detonate, and that the explosive materials contained inside them still pose a risk to civilians even after the batteries run out. In 2022, it's kind of interesting. Biden had revived an Obama-era policy banning the use or transfer of anti-personnel landmines outside the Korean Peninsula. And in fact, in 2020, Biden, as presidential candidate, was very critical of then-President Donald Trump for reversing that policy, calling Trump's move reckless and unnecessary from a military perspective. But now the Biden White House says the mines are needed to help Ukraine fortify its defenses. And as I mentioned, in a little while, we'll talk in a bit more detail about the Russia-Ukraine war, which has brought some truly alarming developments this week that are worth discussing.
And before we get to those truly alarming developments, we'll talk a little bit more about something that others, I guess, have seen as alarming or in many ways concerning, which is the kind of set of nominees that Donald Trump has put forward for various cabinet positions. One that I wanted to talk about briefly and that we talk about in the newsletter this week is Pete Hegseth, who is Trump's nominee for the Secretary of Defense. People in the Democratic Party have highlighted as a potential liability that he was a Fox News host, that he has far-right cultural views, especially related to kind of women's role in society and in the military in particular. And they also note his that there's an allegation of sexual assault against him from 2017 that he settled out of court with the victim who alleges the assault. And then on the kind of establishment foreign policy side, I guess the blob, they're very worried about his lack of managerial experience in a role that will include overseeing the largest agency in the U.S. government, containing some 3 million active employees at any given time. But we kind of saw some aspect of his views was getting less attention. And this, I think we can agree, is going to add some interesting challenges to his tenure as Secretary of Defense if he is put into that position, which is his quite unusual views, I would say fringe views, about Islam and about how Muslims kind of intend to interact with the West. So in a 2020 book called American Crusade, he argued that Islam has, quote, been at war with its enemies, meaning all infidels, since it was founded, and it will never stop. He added that all modern Muslim countries are de facto or formal, quote, no-go zones for practicing Christians and Jews, which is a completely false claim. That is one that I can prove myself as someone who is a practicing Christian who has lived in more than one Muslim country for periods of time, or at least spent time in more than one Muslim country. And this kind of all poses an interesting set of questions because he argues that there is this ongoing war, that Islam kind of as this single figure that he views is engaged in against the West. And this will create some serious challenges for dealing with Muslim leaders. A big part of his job as defense secretary will be dealing with foreign dignitaries. And given America's kind of massive footprint in the Middle East, a lot of them will be Muslim. If he truly believes these things, then it would certainly undermine his ability to work with these people. And if he continues to make comments like this, then there's a real risk that it will lead to either diplomatic incidents or real ones. And then maybe I'll end this with one quote that he had in his book that the Washington Post highlighted that I think is worth highlighting. And it's a little bit longer, but I'll do the whole thing now, which is that, quote, our present moment is much like the 11th century. We don't want to fight, but like our fellow Christians 1,000 years ago, we must. Arm yourself, metaphorically, intellectually, physically. Our fight is not with guns. Yet. And I'll leave it at that. Over to you, Andrew.
Okay, so I'll keep the topic on Trump's nominees, because this week he announced a spate of new picks for top government positions, three of which we write about in today's Earthling. So looking ahead to Senate confirmation hearings, we kind of highlight some issues that are likely to come up in those hearings during questioning. So Trump tapped Chris Wright as energy secretary. Wright is a fracking CEO who last year said, quote, there is no climate crisis and we're not in the midst of an energy transition, end quote. Trump's choice for education secretary is Linda McMahon, a former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment and the wife of wrestling luminary Vince McMahon. In 2009, when Linda McMahon was seeking a post on a state education board, she falsely claimed that she had a bachelor's degree in education. She later retracted that claim, saying she had mistakenly thought her degree was in education rather than French, her actual major. Trump named Brendan Carr as the next chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Carr is a vocal supporter and ally of Elon Musk. The FCC is currently deciding whether to allow Musk's Starlink satellites to orbit closer to Earth, which would apparently make the internet they provide faster, but could worsen the problem of overcrowding in low Earth orbit. Carr has also advocated for giving FCC grants to Starlink as part of this broader broadband expansion program. And he plans to give extra scrutiny, he says, to ex's social media rival Facebook and other members of what he calls the censorship cartel. He's kind of a proponent of free speech kind of person. And this week, we're giving NZN readers a chance to put their forecasting skills to the test. As you know, Connor, we have our own Metaculous community where our readers can assign probabilities to possible future events. And this week we ask, what are the odds that the Senate rejects at least one of Trump's cabinet-level nominees? Now that Representative Matt Gaetz has withdrawn from consideration for Attorney General, the most controversial remaining nominees seem to be Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence and the person you just mentioned, Fox News host Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense. So NZN readers, if they go to the Earthling, they can click a link to take them to the Metaculous community that we have, and they can weigh in on the likelihood that at least one of these controversial nominees will be rejected by the Senate.
Yeah, and we'll probably end up, we may talk about more of that topic with Bob in overtime. So, watch out for potentially more discussion there. But for now, one other topic that I did want to bring up is that there was a new government commission report this week that called for a, quote, Manhattan Project-like effort aimed at building artificial general intelligence before China is able to do so. The report argues that China is rapidly seeking to develop this technology, artificial general intelligence, which, for those who aren't aware of the distinction, current AIs, the LLMs that you may already use in your daily life, are obviously able to do sort of a specific subset of tasks and are able to kind of seem intelligent or to, do things that might feel like intelligence, but an artificial general intelligence, AGI, would be something that surpasses any human at any cognitive task, is able to reason independently, is potentially able to act as an agent, meaning that it's, can use a computer, can impact things in the real world. So this is kind of the, this is the 2001 style HAL supercomputer type thing. And they argue that, we should put an enormous amount of resources behind developing this and preventing China from doing the same. So this should get a lot of support from within the Trump world. Trump himself has not talked about this at great length, except to say that he finds the idea of superintelligence to be scary. But people in his orbit have argued over the past year that this is a crucial thing, that we should be doing these, quote, Manhattan Project-like efforts to expand America's AI industry and to accelerate AGI development. And this will probably get some support within the AI community, which has also shown a desire to kind of race with China on these issues. So critics have pointed out a lot of potential issues with this. I'll just highlight two that listeners should be aware of. One comes to us by way of Garrison Lovely with the Obsolete newsletter. He's a journalist who covers AI quite closely. And he points out that the report fails to marshal any evidence to suggest that China is, in fact, rapidly racing to create AGI. There is reason to believe that China would not want to pursue this for various reasons, including the fact that it is obviously an authoritarian state that likes to protect its information environment, likes to protect itself, and would potentially fear something that could have the destabilizing impacts of AGI. So, you know, that's an open question. And there's also the open question of whether us believing that China is pursuing it will make it more likely, you know, that a self-fulfilling prophecy will occur and that an arms race will ensue. And then I would also note the critique from MIT professor and kind of AI luminary Max Tegmark, who argued that a sprint to AGI would be a, quote, suicide race, under the argument that there is, quote, no reliable way to align its goals and values with our own, end quote, meaning that we may or may not be able to control it in a meaningful way. So that is my last kind of news bite. Do you have any more for us, Andrew?
Yeah, so in addition to that item on AI, we have these three AI updates related to ways that the technology can improve healthcare and possibly threaten the jobs of healthcare professionals. The update that caught my eye was a study by researchers at the University of Virginia who tested whether human doctors or ChatGPT Plus were better at diagnosing illnesses and ailments in tricky medical cases. And there were three groups whose performances were compared in this study. Humans acting alone without the aid of artificial intelligence, ChatGPT Plus acting alone, and humans using ChatGPT Plus. Many people have said that AI won't necessarily replace human workers, but will in many cases lead to these so-called centaurs or humans using AI to augment their productivity. Interestingly, though, while the AI-boosted human researchers performed a little bit better than humans who didn't have AI, the study also found that ChatGPT Plus performed better on its own. So in this case, at least, the AI model was better than the centaurs. And in fact, it was much better, achieving a 92% accuracy rate compared to 76% for the centaurs. And I think that's the last of the items we were going to discuss in this kind of rapid fire way. What did you want to talk about in a bit more detail?
Yeah, I thought one interesting one to highlight would be this news about the International Criminal Court warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant. I think that this is going to be, you know, a lot of people don't really think very much about the ICC in their daily lives, and probably for good reason. You know, it doesn't have an enormous amount of impact on day-to-day international politics, but it's actually had a really important role in the past few years because it's been kind of the central venue in which debates about justice in the international community have played out. So there's a lot to kind of dig in there. But one thing I would just note at the start of this discussion is that Netanyahu and Gallant are now going to have extremely circumscribed ability to travel throughout the world. The theory, the Rome Statute and all states that are parties to the Rome Statute, which is the underlying treaty to the ICC, that mandates that all of those parties consider the ICC to be an essential part of their judiciary and that they must, you know, execute arrest warrants if they are made. And so we've seen a few different states give different answers on this. The Netherlands, where the ICC is actually based, has said that they would execute the arrest warrant and that they would actually go a step further. And in accordance with their interpretation of the Rome Treaty, they would actually reduce contacts with the Israeli government to the minimum necessary in order to not essentially be interacting with potential war criminals. You've seen, you know, Germany seems to be kind of on the fence. They're usually strong defenders of this, especially in the case of the ICC case against Russian President Vladimir Putin, who faces, I believe, it's charges, it's not genocide, but it's charges related to
kidnapping, I believe.
The kidnapping of children, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. So that they've taken children from the areas that they occupy and that is a war crime, that they are not allowed to take those children. And that's been a very important case that even the United States has defended and has actually contributed to. But then now we're seeing, you know, these cases where it's going to really put European states in a difficult place. But yeah, so like Canada said they would arrest. The only states that have said clearly that they wouldn't are Hungary and Argentina, both members of the ICC, but both with very strongly pro-Israel governments have said that they wouldn't. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of curious, Andrew, just to get your general take on this, and then we can kind of dig into it more.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know as much about it as you do. You just said something that you alluded to something that I find kind of interesting, which is that the Biden White House is in a pretty awkward position right now, considering that they basically endorsed the ICC warrant that was issued against Putin. President Biden and other White House officials, to their credit, often did note in discussing that arrest warrant for Putin that the U.S. isn't party to the ICC. The U.S. isn't obligated to kind of participate in this arrest if Putin traveled here. But Blinken, at least, he was being questioned, I think, by Lindsey Graham in some Senate hearing or something. And he said, in answer to Graham's question, that other countries who are members of the ICC should fulfill their obligations and arrest Putin if he comes to their territory. Obviously, now they're singing a very different tune. They flatly rejected the court's decision. And before the court made the decision, they were putting pressure on the ICC not to issue the warrant, right? So I think, you know, one thing that kind of stands out to me about this story is it highlights what many take to be the hypocrisy of the U.S. I just think that the, you know, simultaneous occurrence of the Russia-Ukraine war and the Israel-Palestine war has exposed some contradictions in U.S. policy, or has led to some contradictions in U.S. policy that seemingly undermined the White House's credibility. I mean, this is probably a major example of that. I mean, you mentioned some Western countries that, like U.S. allies that have said, or their leaders have suggested, that they might honor this warrant and they would possibly arrest Netanyahu if he traveled to their territory. I'm wondering, given the kind of pressures that the U.S. could apply on them, like Canada, for example, do you actually think that Canada, if we just stick with that example, would indeed arrest Netanyahu if he traveled there? Because that would be such a significant kind of crazy event if that happened.
Yeah, I don't think that Netanyahu, I don't think we're going to get to test that particular theory. I think that there's no way that Netanyahu goes to Canada. I think there's no way he goes to the Netherlands, to Spain, any of these like cut and dry countries that would definitely arrest him. Because I do think that Canada would definitely arrest him based on the comments that Justin Trudeau made. Unless there's a change of government, there's a chance that it goes to a more conservative government soon and that they may have a different set of views. You know, listeners could go to Paul Bloom episodes of the Non-Zero podcast for all the Canada talk if you want to get more details there. But yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be, so this could hardly come at a worse time for the court, because with Trump coming into office, you know, as some people might remember, Trump issued sanctions against the former ICC prosecutor during his first term in office. He did all kinds of things to kind of complicate the work of the ICC. Previous Republican presidents have viewed it as an infringement on the sovereignty of other countries and on the U.S. itself. In the case of Israel, they're particularly going to be kind of enthusiastically defending the idea that Israel is capable of prosecuting war crimes itself, that it's a democracy with a judiciary that does not need outside assistance from the ICC to achieve justice. That is going to be a central argument made. And I think that we're going to see a revival of these bills that have actually gotten, Democratic support as well as Republican support to increase pressure on the ICC in various ways. So, either to issue sanctions, to take steps to either criminalize or prevent any kind of contacts with the ICC. It's hard to say exactly how far that would go, but I think it's pretty clear to me that it'll be a thorny issue. And on the travel thing, what's tough is that, so Gallant is no longer a member of the government, or he's no longer a minister. For Netanyahu, there's a legal question as to whether diplomatic immunity kind of supersedes a warrant, and whether you should execute a warrant when a head of state is visiting on official state business. This played out in South Africa in, I believe, 2017, when Sudanese president, then president Omar al-Bashir, who remains wanted by the ICC, was visiting. And he went and left and was not arrested by South Africa, even though they are party to the ICC. But that's actually led to an extraordinary amount of anger within South Africa itself. And now it's become clear that the judiciary felt that that was wrong, and that they would mandate an arrest if, for example, Vladimir Putin were to visit. And so that's part of the reason that Putin did not visit South Africa, and that the BRICS summit, the summit of these non-Western states, didn't occur in South Africa as it was scheduled to. I believe it was scheduled to in 2023. So it is a real problem, right? There is a genuine legal question that won't be easily solved from a distance. But for Gallant, if he doesn't have the diplomatic immunity, that whole thing is off the table completely. So he would have to hope that his plane doesn't even make an accidental landing, for example, an emergency landing within a country that is a member of the court. So that'll be a real challenge.
Interesting. You know, some political scientists have argued that there is a pretty major downside to these kinds of arrest warrants, including one professor who's argued this is actually at Northwestern, our mutual alma mater. His last name is Kirk Merrick. I think forgot his first name. But they
Daniel
say
Kirk
that.
Merrick, I think.
Yeah, that's right. But they say, people who make this argument say that world leaders, when they have an arrest warrant against them, when the organs of international law are kind of being arrayed against them, while they're at war, which is usually when this happens, their backs are kind of against the wall, and they have an incentive, like an extra incentive, to win the war and to not wind it down. Because alternatively, you know, they might think, okay, I'll wind down the war, we'll reach some sort of settlement, and then I and my state will kind of be welcomed back into the international community as a player in good standing in the world arena. But when they have this arrest hanging over their head, they kind of hunker down. I don't know how much that logic really applies in the case of Israel, but I guess I can't see why it wouldn't. But you know, these people who make this argument, they're not necessarily opposed to like ICC arrest warrants. They're just kind of highlighting all of the consequences that can unfold. Maybe right. I'll move things on to talk a little bit about the Russia-Ukraine war and some escalatory dynamics that have unfolded this week and have seriously worried many analysts. I've already mentioned Biden's decision to transfer landmines to Ukraine. That decision came on the heels of another more significant decision to let Ukraine strike deep into Russian territory with long-range missiles supplied by the U.S. Following Biden's move, Putin lowered the threshold for Russia's use of nuclear weapons, and under the new doctrine, a retaliatory nuclear strike can be triggered if Russia is attacked using conventional weapons by any nation supported by a nuclear power, which is precisely the kind of attack that Biden gave the green light to this week. And on Tuesday, Ukraine did indeed strike Russia with U.S.-supplied missiles. And then on Wednesday, it struck Russia with missiles supplied by the United Kingdom. And then the day after that, Thursday, Russia launched a new experimental intermediate-range ballistic missile into Ukraine. This missile apparently is different from others that Russia has used in the Ukraine war, in that as it re-enters the atmosphere, it can launch multiple nuclear warheads. So this feature, along with its hypersonic speed, makes it extremely challenging for even the most sophisticated air defense systems to intercept the weapon, a fact that Putin highlighted in an address that he gave following the strike. And during that speech, Putin connected the missile strike to Ukraine's own strikes using Western missiles. And he said that Russia would be entitled to attack NATO countries that are aiding in such Ukrainian strikes into Russian territory. Part of his reasoning there is that Ukraine is unable to operate these long-range missiles without NATO assistance, especially like satellite and guiding assistance for targeting. So Putin says NATO and Russia should be considered to be in direct conflict now that this line has been crossed. And I should say, in case it's not obvious, that, you know, fortunately, obviously, the ballistic missile that Russia fired into Ukraine this week was not carrying a nuclear payload, but the strike was widely seen as a nuclear warning signal to the West, and clearly it was. I mean, so much has happened this week. I'm kind of wondering if I left something out, but is there anything you want to say about these developments?
Yeah, I mean, I would just add that, you know, this multiple reentry vehicle we're talking about, this MRV that, you know, can launch multiple warheads at once from a single missile. This is a type of technology that would, you know, and this type of missile that would set off, you know, all kinds of early warning sensors across the West. And I believe that we have seen that this setup set off kind of these early warning nuclear sensors. And you know, just to really hammer home on that means that there was a period of time, since we can't tell what the payload of with these until they hit, there was a period of time, maybe only a few minutes long, in which the West had to figure out, if Ukraine was about to be nuked, right? So that is the position that we're in right now. It is completely indistinguishable whether that has a nuclear conventional payload, and we had basically no time to respond to that. And if in the future it is carrying a nuclear payload, we will have no time or only a few minutes to respond to that. So this is a particularly dangerous stage of the war. It's almost kind of hard to believe. It's everything has this kind of boil the frog kind of path to it. You know, there have been all of these slow incremental ways in which the war has escalated over the last couple of years, and very logically, right? Because, you know, Ukraine has these fundamental disadvantages. It's in their interest to deepen Western involvement in the war and to get access to more effective Western weapons. And because of that, Russia has, you know, increasingly pulled up the threshold, and or I guess lowered the threshold now for nuclear cross. So they need to do something strong to restore that deterrence. So we're entering a really dangerous time, or we're continuing in a dangerous time, because it has been dangerous.
Yeah, and I'll say apparently the Kremlin did pick up the special phone, like the hotline phone, and gave, I think, like 30 minutes warning to the U.S. at least before firing this missile.
All right.
Some people have taken solace in that fact. I think I saw Emma Ashford, the international relations scholar and foreign policy analyst. She noted on X that it's actually kind of disturbing that we're at the point where the Kremlin is placing calls using the phone that's specifically for like sharing information about nuclear war and trying to avert that. But it is at least good that they gave the warning. I guess one question that we could maybe briefly discuss before ending, and then Bob will come on, is like, what is the Biden administration up to exactly? You know, their express rationale for the landmines makes sense. They want to stop Russia's advances in eastern Ukraine, and landmines are pretty good at that, whatever, they're dangerous to civilians. But as far as the, you know, the decision to let Ukraine use these long-range missiles in Russia, the rationale they provided was sort of garbled. Like they said, well, it's because of the North Koreans entering the fight, because there's, you know, thousands of North Korean troops now who are helping the fight in Kursk. And the connection never really made sense to me. I mean, I could kind of understand on the level of like, okay, so Russia's third party country allies are getting more involved, so Ukraine's also need to get involved to show that they also are supporting their ally. I could kind of see that maybe, but Ukraine didn't actually use these U.S. supplied missiles to strike Kursk and to target the North Koreans who are helping to retake the Kursk region, which is a region in Russia that Ukraine invaded in August, I think this summer sometime. The British, you know, what are they called? Storm Shadow missiles. Those were used in Kursk, but Biden's were not. And, you know, some people have suggested that Biden is intentionally trying to complicate and hamper Trump's ability once he becomes president to pursue a peace deal by crossing all these red lines and I guess just making the war generally more complicated and tense. Another possible explanation is that the Biden White House is just trying to get all these weapons out the door before the change in administration, and, you know, for fear that Trump is going to cut off the flow of aid to Ukraine. Do you have any thoughts about what the White House is up to?
Yeah, I have a hard time believing that their goal is escalation per se, right? They've shown a lot of fear about that, and they've also shown a lot of distrust of it. And I think that if their goal is to make it as dangerous as possible right before Trump takes office, I see some tension there. I think the thing that does make the most sense is the latter one that you said, which is that, you know, in particular with regard to these new missiles or these new like landmines they're sending, different things like that, I think that they're trying to get as much out the door as possible. They're trying to make sure that Trump is not able to cut off the supply of weapons, which, to be clear, Trump has not said explicitly that he will immediately cut off the supply of weapons or anything like that. That's a complicated topic that I know, Andrew, you have quite a lot of thoughts on. So maybe we can discuss that a little bit more later. But yeah, I think the broader thing is they're trying to reestablish deterrence in a sense. They're trying to kind of fit the new red lines, and they're arguing that since Putin has escalated by sending these North Korean soldiers, that there needs to be a parallel escalation that shows that the U.S. is able to kind of match them. It's a delicate line to walk. It's a delicate line to walk. And I definitely don't think that it's as easy to control as some members of the administration might hope.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with this military conversation, if we want to call it that, is, you know, there's not an infinite number of rungs on the ladder of escalation to nuclear war, right? And this latest missile strike by Russia must be pretty near the top of that ladder. I guess they could also do a kind of demonstration nuclear explosion, you know, away from the battlefield, away from Ukrainians. But anyway, I think that's all for the items from this week's Earthling. So now let's say hi to Bob. Bob, welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. How are you guys? How did you do in the early part of the taping? Did you do me proud?
I think so. It was very rapid fire today, and I think we covered every topic that deserved to be covered in this week's busy news week.
That's impressive. Well, you guys are young. You know, the synapses are really firing, so we expect rapid fire. And now it's at this point that people have to crank it up to 1.8, because I'm showing up. So, yeah. So we're gonna like move more or less directly into overtime is the idea, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Before we do that, two things. First of all, people should follow us on Blue Sky. We're opening up a second front in the social media wars.
I still need to make my account, but I will make one.
Well, isn't there a non-zero account?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Have we memorized it by heart?
Connor knows, I think.
Connor's in charge of that. Connor, a lot of pressure.
Nonzeronews.bluesky.official.
Okay, so it's at nonzero news, which is one word, I gather. Dot.
Right.
Now, mine is .bsky.app. Is that the standard protocol, or are there varieties?
A variety. Yeah. I see. But ours is .bsky.social. But it'll show up if you look up.
Oh, .social, that's right. It's not .a. Oh, so and mine is at Robert Ryder, one word, .bsky.social. That's true. Okay, now, before we go into overtime, I've got great paywall bait. Okay, so listen, tell me what you think. This could become our whole business model. Tell me what you think. So a few weeks ago, as non-zero members who get access to the overtime of all these podcasts know, I regaled Paul Bloom with tales of my going to an optician because I wanted to get fitted for glasses, because I've long been a contact lens wearer that has problems, because, you know, when I need, you know, I need, you know, the reading, I actually should have bifocals, or is, you know, the modern incarnation being progressive lenses. And they have progressive contact lenses. I refuse to believe they work. I've been using this imperfect solution of a so-called mono lens, where you actually have one of the eyes is actually getting less correction than it needs for distance. That has downsides. So anyway, I got these glasses. Okay. But I'm not sure. It's a radical look. It's going to be very controversial. Radical look. There's a story behind these frames that I will share with you in overtime.
So you putting on the glasses, that's the paywall bait?
That's the paywall. Because I'm honestly not sure if I should go public with these. Should I wear them on the other side, on, you know, on the free side of the paywall in the future? And I'm going to get your guidance and the guidance of any members. And, you know, if people want to go the rest of their lives without having ever seen me in these, in the case that I don't keep wearing them, like if you guys give me the thumbs down verdict, I don't keep wearing them, this will have been the last chance to see them. I mean, if people want to go their whole lives without having seen me in these eyeglasses, it's their call. It seems like a hell of a burden to carry through life to me. But that is the decision they face. We're going to go in overtime. I'm going to put these glasses on and tell you the whole story behind the frames. I mean, these are controversial. This is wild.
I can't wait. I hope they're like thick-rimmed, red, circular glasses.
All I'm going to say is these make like a Matt Gaetz party look tame, okay?
Wow.
And the way that people can get access to the overtime segment and other exclusive audio content, of course, is to go to the Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack and become an NZN member today. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So
and
let's go
to
overtime.
We're also going to talk about other stuff besides eyeglasses, I should emphasize.
While you're wearing them, we'll talk about Matt Gaetz, maybe Russia, Ukraine, artificial intelligence.
Maybe some AI, maybe Pete. I can never remember how to pronounce it.
Hegseth.
Yeah. Why is it?
It's a weird name.
It is a weird name. Okay. So, yeah. So now we hope, thanks to everybody who's, even those who are choosing not to follow us into overtime, however unwisely. I'm polishing lenses even as we speak, just to add to the drama.
Wow.
Okay. And thanks to them and thanks to people who are going to follow us. And now we are going into overtime.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.